Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk about the world of wildlife with our resident experts and guests on the show. Oh my gosh, this could be a lot of fun. David Drake and Jamie Nack back with us. David's a UW Extension wildlife specialist and professor. David, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Don't put too much pressure on us. Don't tell us as experts yet. Thank you, Larry. Nice to see you.
Oh, good to see you. And Jamie Nack, of course, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, good to see you as well.
It's great to be back.
And, of course, both are affiliated with Extension and with the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. I wanted to mention that. Questions for them? Have you been sighting some animals or have a question about them? Maybe you saw a funny-looking deer or rabbit out there. We'll get into that with our guests. But I hope you'll join in with your questions. And if you have a wildlife photo you want to share with us, you can do that as well. To share that photo or to email a question, go to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Or give a call to 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Jamie, let's start with you. There are, in northern Wisconsin, some rabbits that, with the horn-like growths and on their heads, I've seen them, they do look terrible. What's happening with those rabbits?
Yeah, so there's been some reports, and also I believe in Colorado there were some reports, and this has kind of been stirred up then in the media. But this also may be the virus that causes this, may be what's linked to folks calling or talking about the jackalope.
Yeah.
So we don't know if that's true, where that came from, those horn-like growths, or when taxidermists put antlers on a rabbit.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but if you've seen pictures of these rabbits, they are, I don't even know how to describe it, but they've
you feel bad for the rabbit.
You feel bad, yeah. They look like tentacles or horn-like pieces kind of sticking out of their ears, their head, could be around their eyelids. The good news is this virus that causes it, it's called Shope papillomavirus. It's named Shope from the researcher who first discovered it back in the 1930s and identified the virus. And the Shope papillomavirus is specific to rabbits, so it's pretty species specific. It's not something that humans can get, so it's a non-zoonotic disease. It does not transfer into humans. But there are other versions of it in deer, and maybe we'll talk about that later. But in terms of the rabbits, it's this virus that creates growths. They're basically a proliferation of the host's own cells, so the rabbit's own cells, the epithelial cells, the connective tissue, and fibroblasts that kind of form this growth that comes out of the head region generally. Typically, rabbits are able to fight off that virus and recover from it. And the problem is when those growths cover their eyes or cover their mouths, it can make it hard for them in terms of eating and functioning, maybe more vulnerable to predation and things like that. So,
so it's a virus. So once it's, I imagine contact and so forth with other rabbits, that's how it gets spread.
Yes. Yeah, so it gets spread through the bite of mosquitoes or ticks. So the virus enters into the skin surface. It can get then crossed from one rabbit to another through the transfer of that mosquito host. And then also there's, kind of at least to be vigilant with domestic rabbits at this time of the year as well. But for the most part, this is something that has been occurring for years. There seems to be a slight uptick. There was one report last year, and I think there's been 23 rabbits reported so far in Wisconsin this year. Those are coming in from St. Croix, Dunn, Pierce, and Polk counties. Lots of theories on why there might be this slight uptick, but again, we're talking about 22 more individuals this year than last year, so a pretty small number.
Once somebody sees it and it gets out on social media, it's like, they're everywhere.
It's a little startling to see an animal like that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is to note when it comes to wildlife diseases, I think the biologists are interested in hearing about those sightings and those reports. And so if you were to go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website and just type in wildlife or reporting sick wildlife, there's an online report form where you can report that location, what you saw, upload a picture if you have one, and they are kind of keeping track of those reportings, sightings.
Well, the other is deer, and, you know, I think some of the media folks are calling Frankenstein deer. And the photos I've seen of these deer are just, you feel so bad for the deer. What's going on? Is it the same kind of thing, a virus? Or?
So I think it varies depending on, every incident could be different. So deer have all sorts of different growths that they could have. It could be an injury from, it could be a buck that had a tine from another buck during the rut. Enter its body and build an abscess around it. It could be a tumor, but they also have wart-like fibromas that are virus similar to what we were just talking about in rabbits. And so that is also a wart-like growth that you'll see all over the bodies. Those are considered a fibroma. And we also see that in squirrels, except that the cause for squirrels is a squirrel pox. And it's a pox virus versus this papilloma virus. So, but it results in warty growths all over squirrels.
And all, I'm telling you, some of the deers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're, what, a third covered? With,
right.
It was just off. It's just awful. So is it going to kill them or is it?
So from what I was reading, especially from the viral causes, the animal's eventually able to shed that in most cases and then recover. But again, if those growths are blocking or hindering its vision or its ability to eat, it could succumb to other causes. I didn't see anything. Again, it's not a zoonotic disease, so it's not going to cross into humans. And as far as consuming meat from those animals, I didn't see any advisories saying you couldn't. So,
well, let's turn to CWD for a minute, just to keep on this very positive conversation that we're having here. Oh my goodness! Yeah. There was a good thing here. A large study of chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin deer recently won a National Wildlife Restoration Award, David.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, just for anybody who may have been under a rock for the last 2.5 decades, you know, chronic wasting disease is a disease that is caused by a prion, that kind of essentially a protein that has gone bad in the deer's brain. It can be a longer lasting disease, so you may not see signs of a deer having chronic wasting disease until the end stage of that animal's life, where maybe they start salivating or they're very emaciated, things like that. Chronic wasting disease was first found in Wisconsin, here in the southwestern part of Wisconsin, in 2001. And it's been heavily studied since then across the United States. I think there's 55 of the 72 counties in Wisconsin right now have reported CWD positive diseases, either free ranging diseases or a free ranging deer or farm raised deer. So it's spreading obviously across the state as it is across many states in the United States. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, along with many partners, including our department, the U.S. Geological Survey, Wildlife Cooperative Cooperative Research Unit here in our department, some other areas, have partnered to study chronic wasting disease for many, many years. And it's probably outside of maybe Colorado and some other states, there's probably not much more research on CWD that's gone on other than Wisconsin here. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources was honored for that through the Wildlife Society, which is our professional society, international society. They won the Wildlife Restoration Award, and it might seem a little weird to have it called the Wildlife Restoration Award, but Wildlife Restoration Award is projects that are funded through Pittman-Robertson, which is an ex-federal excise tax that's put on hunting gear and ammunition and things like that. And then that money is split up across the 50 states and is put back into wildlife restoration. So habitat acquisition, habitat management, game species management, things like that. So that's why it's the Wildlife Restoration Award. And they won in the Wildlife Research and Survey category. So, it's a wonderful recognition for all of the hard work that they've put in for many, many years. I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of people, wonderful partnerships, and obviously it's got great application and relevance for many states east of the Great Plains who are also battling chronic wasting disease in their own state.
Yeah. And I think it means a lot to the researchers for DNR receive an award.
Yeah, absolutely. And so well deserved. Just the recognition. This was a huge undertaking. The logistics involved, the staff time, and they'll continue to process data and analyze data, asking different research questions. But they collared over 1,200 animals. That includes deer, along with bobcats and coyotes, some of the predator community that they were following as well. They had 1,000 volunteers that were helping with these capture efforts. Some of that includes volunteers that helped search for fawns to put fawns collars on fawns. And then the other huge group to thank are the landowners that allowed access.
Yeah. Yep.
Over 400 landowners that they worked with. So phase one was essentially involved all the collaring of these animals. And phase two, which began in 2020 and will continue for who knows how long, involves tracking the deaths, analyzing data, and then publishing additional study findings and results. So a lot more to come. And if you're interested in reading some of the research results, again, you can go to the Department of Natural Resources website and search for the Southwest Deer Predator Study. And they have lots of great articles, reports, tables, figures, and so on.
Yeah, and probably one of the most impactful results that they've discovered so far is that once the CWD prevalence in female deer reaches 29% or greater, they start seeing a decline in the overall deer population. So it has real application for how they manage deer. So many people are deer hunters in the state. It's the culture of deer hunting. It's also one of the ways that the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources funds their annual budget is through the sale of licenses. So it has real ramifications based on how many deer are on the landscape, and not only for the health of the deer, but also the economics of the state, the culture of deer hunting, and many other things.
Jamie, you mentioned bobcat, and we got a nice photo of one from Owen in Cornucopia, recently spotted.
Beautiful.
Yeah,
through the
really
window.
Pretty.
Yeah. So it was pretty close.
Yeah.
And one more photo before we take some calls here. Owen shared a photo of a super relaxed bear, and you've got this bear kind of sitting up on his butt.
Yep,
and
grooming itself, huh?
Yeah.
Grooming itself. So, hey, thanks for sending those
great
photos.
Great pictures.
Great photos. Well, let's turn our attention to birds here for a minute. Abby in Polk County has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Abby.
Hi. It was great that you're on today, because yesterday we had an owl hanging around. Well, I went outside to do something, and I saw an owl, and it was eating something, and it didn't really notice that I was coming up upon it, so I took, a 10-minute video of it, but it was a barred owl. I sent a couple pictures in, but I don't know if you'll get them. But I was able to get so close to it. I mean, honestly, I think if I probably could have touched it. It was so it hung around our house all day. It went from place to place to perch and stuff. So I was just wondering if it would have been, because it looked like it was healthy. It flew and everything, but
yeah.
I was just kind of wondering if it might be a juvenile barred owl, but the behavior just seemed odd to me.
And okay. All right. Well, Abby, thanks for calling. What about it, David?
Yeah. Hi, Abby. Thank you very much for that account. So a couple of things. So obviously barred owls are one of our more common owl species in the state. They're a relatively large sized owl. Very cool. You hear them a lot more often than you see them. They have that very common, well-known "Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you all?" call, which is pretty cool. And as for the account that you talked about, there may be a couple of reasons. Obviously, if it was eating something, that is very distracting for that owl, and it may have just been so focused on consuming the food that it found that may be one reason that it was so approachable. The other issue is, and this is not unique to owls, but this is very common for any other species that lives around human beings regularly is that they will habituate or get used to human presence. And because of that, they don't flee or they don't act like an animal that would be out in the wild or out in the rural part of the state where they don't see as many human beings, and they might fly away from you quicker and you wouldn't be able to get as close to them. So probably maybe a combination of things, but obviously I think that that animal was probably distracted from food. And I would suspect that if it was eating, it was probably a healthy animal and probably behaving as it should.
Yeah.
It may have just been distracted by its food source and or habituated and used to people, and you just didn't look that scary.
Yeah. I was thinking back a couple of years ago, a Cooper's Hawk had a rabbit, was eating a rabbit along the sidewalk. You're on campus. I was 3 feet away from that hawk. Yeah. I just sat there and watched it, and it didn't pay any attention to me.
So
at
cool.
All.
Yeah,
it's really
very
neat.
Cool. Abby, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on the World of Wildlife program. Larry Mueller here with my guests David Drake and Jamie Nack from UW-Madison and UW Extension. Great to have them with us today. And I hope you'll join in with your questions, comments. You can email a question or photo to talk at WPR.org or give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Marion Mountain, Wisconsin, emailed to say they live in the North Woods and is noticing the phenology. They keep track of the phenology calendar, and it seems a few weeks early, wondering if this is also happening in other areas of the state. Are the critters near Mary predicting an early winter?
Well, I wish we had her on the line so we could ask what some of the examples she had, what she feels has been early. And I, too, pay attention to the phenology calendar. I don't know if we're looking at the same one, but the Aldo Leopold Foundation puts out a phenology calendar based on records from Aldo Leopold and Nina, his daughter. And phenology is the study of kind of the timing of different events. So whether it's, when purple coneflowers bloom or when hummingbirds migrate, things like that. And so the calendar has the average dates based on however many decades of recording that phenology information on an annual basis. So, in terms of just looking at it, I know having looked at that calendar, ruby-throated hummingbirds I've been watching, there's been a little bit more of an uptick in activity around my feeders. We're likely seeing some of the northern birds starting to move south. That doesn't mean take your feeders, down if you're in the north, but leave them up for a while because you may still have some birds that have started migrating, and that's an important resource for them for stopover habitat. A couple other things, bucks are starting to shed their velvet. So prior to the upcoming deer season, we'll start to see more of the bucks getting that velvet off of their antlers. And then for some of the birds, we've got some of the migratory Canada geese, so not our resident geese, but the migratory birds are starting to show up, and we'll start to continue to flock up or roost in like at places like Horicon National Wildlife Refuge and things like that. And ducks like blue-winged teal are starting to move through as well. So
lots going on.
Yeah, lots going on, and hard to say for specifically, that anything is earlier until we continue to document and then kind of look at those trends over time.
Yeah, but to that point, I mean, there has been plenty of documentation that with climate change, we are seeing range expansion, for example. So species are moving further north than they normally would. And we're also seeing the phenology shift where things are starting to emerge earlier or natural events, as Jamie talked about, are occurring earlier or at a different time than has been noted, a number of decades ago. So there is a real consequence and kind of cause and effect from climate change for that.
Let's take some more calls. Jane in Cushing will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a question about the impact on not just bears, but all wildlife and birds where there is a law in Wisconsin that was written by lobbyists and passed so that people can run hounds to chase bear 24 hours a day beginning July 1st to August 31st. And where I live, I've seen packs, groups of people, up to 36 hounds running through the woods. And they have also tried a year ago to extend that to include all of May and June also. And there's virtually zero regulation of who can do it, how, and trust me, it happens all night long. We've even had people come as far away as Tennessee. There's no numbers on how many people are out there, et cetera. So what is the impact on the birds, the other wildlife, et cetera?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good question. The season that you're talking about is the training season for bear hunter, for those who use dogs to harvest bears. And I guess to back up a little bit, in Wisconsin, we have about 24,000 black bears, and there's a couple of different methods that are legal to use to harvest bears. One of them is the use of trailing hounds. So those are dogs that sometimes you start at a bait site where you've been attracting bears to come in and leave their tracks, leave their scent, put a trail camera on it, be able to monitor that location to see if you have, for instance, a sow with cubs coming in. If that's the case, you would not want to be starting dogs on that bait because it's illegal to harvest a sow with cubs. So it's a way to kind of monitor and get a judgment for the size of the bears coming in. If you had, for example, wolves coming in with bears, that might be a place where you're not going to start your dogs either because of wolf presence in the area. So bait sites are often used to start dogs, although there are some other methods of using dogs, but the dogs then can track the bears. And the idea is that they're trying to essentially find the bear bedded for the day, jump it, and continue to follow it until it either trees or gets away, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the types of habitat they're in are usually thick coniferous swamps, tag alders, areas that are a lot of work to move around in and continue to pursue these animals. So that is one method. Another method is hunting over bait, is legal in Wisconsin. And then third would be simply like stalking or setting up somewhere in hopes of a bear crossing your path, which is not, you know, usually a high success rate at all. That being said, today is the start of the bear hunting season in Wisconsin. The dog hunters in the northern zones, there's 6 bear management zones. The 3 northern zones, you can use trailing hounds. And they start first this year. So they start this Wednesday, and then next week other forms of legal harvest are allowed as well. And so part of it, with 24,000 bears on the landscape, these are some of the methods that are used to help manage and to balance habitat and expanding bear populations. So primarily bears are in the 2/3 part of the state, northern and central forest, but they are slowly expanding south. And bear hunting is, again, one of the ways that we can manage that population. What I want to track back to is just to say that there are many regulations when it comes to using the use of trailing hounds. If you're hunting with a party of people, you may only have 6 dogs on a chase. You can substitute dogs, but 6 dogs is the maximum number you can have. So you can't have 30 dogs chasing a bear. So that provides an element of fair chase. Obviously, permissions. Baiting has limits in terms of how much the quantity of bait that you can put down, the container or how it is capped on a wood.
A hollow
log. You can't have exposed bait, so that you're really targeting an animal that is strong enough to pull a rock off of a hollow stump and be able to access that bait, things like that. The training period is really set up to allow hunters who use dogs an opportunity to train their dogs, and so that they're trained on pursuing bear rather than coyotes or other species, and kind of getting them in shape in preparation for the hunt.
In terms of the impact, I guess your question was, what's the impact on on bears or other wildlife?
Yep. Yeah. And I do have experience both using trailing hounds, whether that be for bear or other species, but also just using dogs for raccoon hunting, dogs for upland game hunting, running dogs, you know, in general. And my experience is typically that they are moving through that area. They are honed in on that species that you want them to be pursuing. So they're focused on that bear. Does that mean that they couldn't knock a nest over in a shrub or, you know, cause a deer to, you know, split from its fawn for a little bit? I think, you know, those are possible. I think that doe is going to come back and retrieve her fawn. It's a short disturbance, and then the animals will go back to their normal activity.
But the impact would probably be temporary and
temporary. And there's been some research that looks at the use of, I believe it was dogs for raccoon hunting and hunting a property for raccoons in the evening, and then the next day, you know, what happened with the deer? And they just, again, stick to a home range and will circle their way back in a period of time and resume their typical daily habits.
Jane, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Steve in Ellison Bay next. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, the question I had is we had a pair of, I guess, snowy egrets that would roost on the opposite side of a pond. And, you know, one day there were a bunch of feathers and a wing on the top of our roof, and then there were feathers and little bits on top of a car, and there were a bunch of feathers on the opposite side of the pond. So obviously something got to one of those egrets, and I'm wondering what would be big enough to attack one of those birds.
Yeah, that's a good question. So snow egrets are super cool, all white wading birds. They've got black legs, and they're similar to a great egret, but great egrets are larger in size. And I know size is relative, so if you only have see one of those birds, what you want to look at is the feet. So snow egrets have light-colored or yellow feet, and great egrets have black feet. In terms of what might have gotten that bird, it could have been a bald eagle. I suspect it's some other type of aerial predator, like some bird, since you found parts of the egret on top of your house and other places like that. But I would guess probably a bald eagle would be my guess. I don't know, Jamie, if you've got a different guess than
that. Yeah, I'm not sure if an eagle will take, you know, how often they would take an egret.
An owl.
But I would say owl or,
yeah, maybe
or a
owl.
Hawk.
Yeah, yeah,
owl.
True.
That's but another possibility.
I agree, an aerial predator. And, of course, those egrets kind of stand out with their white plumage. So,
yes, they do.
Yeah.
I had another photo texted to me that I want to show you of a goose amidst the only one amidst a group of Canada geese.
Yeah.
And wondering what that goose was.
It looks to me just like a domestic farm goose. That
it does.
That's what I think.
Wild Canada geese.
It's an amazing. It was the only one amidst this flock of Canada geese.
Was it an urban setting?
Yeah,
on a golf course.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It does look like a domestic goose.
Yeah,
but but you'd think in the middle of
looking
Madison,
for friends.
Oh yeah,
horse and golf.
Yeah, so there's
Madison.
A lot of domestic geese and ducks that are especially in city parks or around cities, water bodies.
They kind of escape and.
Yep.
And away they go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to Terry in Rome, Wisconsin. Terry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Good morning. I live in Adams County, the northern part of Adams County, adjacent to Wood County. And some solar farm investors are wanting to put a 2,000-acre solar farm in the town of Rome. And directly to the north of that, within a couple miles to the north of that, in Saratoga, there's already two huge solar farms that total more than 2,000 acres as well. The combination of those three solar farms would be larger than any solar farm in the country. And I'm wondering if the DNR is weighing in on the long-term negative impact that removing all of those trees and stripping the the landscape right down to the ground in such a large area is how it's going to negatively affect the wildlife and ecology, especially deer, birds, even the bears and squirrels.
All right, let's start with Jamie.
So Terry, just to clarify, neither David or I work for the Department of Natural Resources. So I would just say that as to whether they're weighing in, I am not 100% sure. So that's a question that can be asked of your local biologist. And then additionally, I would say this is probably an issue for you to raise with legislators or also the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, who was involved in the, I don't know if settlement's the right word, but the discussion on the solar farms in the Buena Vista grasslands and the concern for the prairie chicken habitat in that area, and was able to weigh in and have some changes made with that proposed plan. So a couple of avenues would be, you know, again, to seek out some answers from your local biologist, the local DNR office. You could reach out to the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation.
So I think I'm not as familiar with solar projects as I am with wind energy projects, but I'm assuming, based on the industrial size of that the Public Service Commission is the permitting authority. And as part of that permitting, then they're going to have to go through a whole bunch of environmental impact statements. So they will. So the solar company or whoever's developing the solar, I'm sure, is going to have to put together an environmental impact as to the impact of removing trees, installing the solar farm. Every solar farm's got to have a fence around it to fence things out. So that all will be summarized in the environmental impact statement. You probably could get a hold of that through the Public Service Commission, I'm assuming. There is not as much study or research on solar farms as there is on wind energy, although it is starting to catch up a little bit because solar is the faster-growing renewable energy sector. So there is obviously some habitat loss with the removal of the trees, and then with the installation of the panels and then also the fencing there. But a lot of times those solar farms are put into places where maybe the habitat is marginal to begin with. So it might be on an agricultural landscape or in an area that maybe is barren or is fallow, and maybe the habitat is not as developed or as managed as perhaps it could be in some other areas. So I'm assuming that solar farm is going to have some impact, but I'm guessing it probably is going to be somewhat minimal, especially depending on the size and depending on the type of habitat that is surrounding that solar farm, even though they're removing the trees in that area.
I've just got a note to hear that solar-related permits are typically reviewed in DNR's Office of Energy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Rather than in the individual programs or regional offices.
Yes. Okay.
But I think Public Service Commission, I think they're the permitting authority, and then they work with other state agencies as appropriate. So yeah. DNR would be certainly one of those agencies.
And certainly, and the large scale, another note here, the large scale solar projects are reviewed by the PSC, Public Service Commission, and the DNR.
Yep.
PSC reviews all projects over 100 megawatts in size, and many projects submitted by public utilities. The public input stage for those projects happens through the joint PSC-DNR review process.
And is that 100 megawatts, is that for wind or is that also for solar? Because I know that for wind, anything above 100 megawatts that...
All projects over 100 megawatts.
Okay. Awesome.
Excellent. Well, thank you to the listener that provided that excellent information.
Yeah, or it might have been Jeff Robbins, our technical director, or Joel Patnaud, our producer, who provided that. One or the other of them. I'm pretty sure of that. Terry, thanks. Daniel in Rice Lake will give you a chance. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning. I was kind of wanting to hear about the update on the wolf harvest season coming up.
Probably that relates to the population, the wolf population. And David, I don't know.
Probably the best thing to do is to just to make sure that we're giving you the most current information is to go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website. And on their website, they have a search engine. And I would just search in wolf harvest 2025 or 2026.
Yeah, we don't don't have the most current right here, so that's probably the best way to do it, Daniel. Thanks for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Question or comment, experience to share, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And our caller earlier who had asked about Bardolls or commented on Bardolls sent a couple of nice photos of that Bardoll.
Sure did.
Yeah, it's a couple of nice photos. Mayor emailed to say they have a white crow visiting their property regularly, has a distinctive call compared to the black ones. Mary runs outside to see it when they hear it.
Huh. Well, I don't think you would mistake a crow's call. And we only have one species of crow here. So
it's an albino.
The only other, and where are they located, do they say?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, so the only other bird you might mistake that with is a raven, but that would be up in the northern part of the state.
Right, right.
Not in where like central or north central south. And, you know, occasionally birds do lack color in their plumage, and that could be the case with this crow. But it shouldn't have an impact on the call of that crow. So that would be a little unusual. But I don't think you would mistake a crow, even if it was white, blue, or black. So that's an interesting observation for sure.
Yeah. The photo we have now, and I'm not sure if you're going to be able to see it or not, Brian in Fontana emailed to say that earlier this year, a picture of a ruff grouse was captured on a snapshot Wisconsin trail camera in Walworth County near Geneva Lake. The identification was confirmed by the snapshot team. Any idea of why a ruffed grouse would be this far in the state? And I can't
see. Yeah, I don't see it in the picture at all. But
well,
you know,
it was identified, and it was in Geneva Lake, which
is down the southeastern part of the state.
Southeastern.
Which is, I mean, we have them in the southwestern part of the state.
Southwestern.
Yeah.
Could it be a release or an escape from?
Ruffed grouse are usually not birds that are raised in captivity. They're really difficult to raise. But anything is possible, as we've heard on the show numerous times. I can't see the bird in the picture here, but
I don't either.
You know, historically there were grouse certainly in the southeast. We still have birds in the southwestern part of the state, although their populations are not doing great over the last couple of decades.
Oh, there it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in the lower left hand, its tail is facing us.
Yep.
Or no, its head is facing us, excuse me. Yeah, there it is right
there. Yep. Okay, now we can see it. And of course,
You can see coloration on the banding of the tail, so that definitely is a rough grouse.
Yeah, it definitely looks like a rough grouse, and how it got there. And if it's...
Well, it could have taken a wrong turn at Richland Center and headed east. I mean, you know, there's
possibly
also a lot of commerce that's going across the state. And I don't know, the bird might have gotten caught up in, I don't know, some wood product or some other kind of product. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's hitched a ride.
Reminds me of the prairie dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Story.
Right.
Made its way to Wisconsin in a bale of hay.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, the last couple of years, you know, we've had roseated spoonbill. We've had wood stork recently.
Grouse isn't migratory. So
no,
this
the grouse is not
a,
migratory, but I'm saying there's so many birds that come, you know, from many, many states away that are accidentals here. So for a rough grouse to go from the southwest part of the state to the southeast is not all that unusual.
Yeah.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. We're talking the world of wildlife, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk the world of wildlife with our two guests from the UW-Madison, David Drake and Jamie Nack. Lots of callers online. We've got some questions, so let's go back to the phones and to Jerry in Green Bay. Jerry, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a comment. Maybe it's more of a question than a comment, but my question is, do they have surveys of the amount of the mice that are in the woodlands?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a couple of years ago that, it might be 3 years already, that I was listening to this program, and they spoke about the mouse being the vector for the wood tick.
Yeah.
Yeah, so typically, so mice are a type of small mammal that we have in the state, and we've got dozens of small mammal species. But typically, there is no survey of small mammals in the state of Wisconsin, or any other state for that matter. There are research projects, so we have colleagues here at the UW-Madison campus who are doing research on ticks, and they are trapping small mammals to test for Lyme disease and small mammals for tick abundance on those animals, things like that. And the white-footed mouse is the reservoir for Lyme disease. There has been some hypothesis, and I don't know where this research has gone, but there's been some hypothesis that in areas where you see an increase in the abundance of red fox, you don't have as high of an incidence of Lyme disease because red fox are such good mousers, if you will. And I'm not sure if anybody's actually conducted that research to see if that hypothesis holds true or not. But it's the white-footed mouse that's the reservoir, the primary reservoir for Lyme disease here in the state of Wisconsin.
Jerry, thank you for calling. Rick in Elkhart Lake, we'll go to you. Hi, Rick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. It's east central Wisconsin. And this year we have a swan that has shown up in our lake. Never had it before. It's a lonely swan, and I wonder if you had any ideas on that. If maybe it's someone's pet that got loose, or do they show up occasionally? But this is a first for me living in Elkhart Lake. And because it's alone, I was wondering if maybe did it lose its mate. I have read or heard that they mate for life because it's just a single swan in our lake. The only time I've seen them is in parks where I think they have their wings clipped. And the other question I have is, we don't have as many seagulls this year, and someone has said seagulls don't like swans, so that's why the seagull population is less.
What did the swan look like? Was it?
Yeah.
They said it was, somebody said it was a muted swan, not a trumpeter swan.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. It's most likely a mute swan is what you're seeing. So if you get a chance, just go to your search engine on your internet and type in mute swan and then tundra swan, and you can see the difference between the two species. Typically, mute swans have more of a S to their neck. Trumpeter or tundra swans have more of a straight neck. Again, big white birds, all three of the species are. The trumpeter and the tundra are native to Wisconsin. The mute swan is not. And so a lot of times people have brought mute swans in to especially urban wetland areas or urban parks that have lakes for the aesthetics of it. In areas where you have overabundance of Canada geese, because swans can be aggressive, especially mute swans, people have brought them in as a way to try to push the Canada geese out of that area, with mixed results on that. But I'm assuming it's a mute swan that you have there. There has been an effort to get rid of mute swans because they are competing with the native swan species that we have here. So you may want to just check with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources or at least your city municipality and see if they want to what they want to do about that swan, and just to confirm it is a mute swan. In addition. So as we mentioned, mute swans can be aggressive toward other, especially waterfowl. I'm not aware of them being aggressive toward gulls. And then I will just say, as an aside, there is no such species as a seagull if you look up in a bird book. So that is that's just kind of a common misnomer that we have perpetuated through time. So I'm not familiar with the fact that with gulls being chased off by swans, and it could just be that we have ring-billed gulls is probably one of the most common species of gull we have in the state of Wisconsin, and that is probably the gull species that you are probably most familiar with or you may see most commonly, and that species of gull they move around quite a bit, and they are pretty good about finding food out of dumpsters in cities as well as out of natural areas. So it could just be that the gull, whatever gull species you're looking at, that they found a source of food or something about a habitat that they've liked someplace else, and they just haven't been around your lake this summer.
Yeah. Rick, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. And Kent in Clintonville. We'll go to you now. Hi, Kent.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question concerning ruffed grouse and their relationship with wild turkeys. I hunted ruffed grouse in Calumet County, Manitowoc County, Wapaka, most of central Wisconsin back in the 70s and 80s, and there were lots of grouse. They were plentiful, and at that time, the wild turkeys hadn't quite taken off in Wisconsin yet, except for the Southwest. And I have a theory, and now they're gone. You can't find. I can walk the same woods that I walked in, 50 years ago, and there's no grouse. I have a theory that they compete for nesting areas with wild turkeys. I asked one of the DNR worker about that. He said, well, it's habitat, but I don't believe it's a habitat. I think there's that they compete for nesting areas. What would you think about that?
So Ken, I'm happy to take this question. I wish I had a dollar every time we were
asked.
I'm
going to split that dollar
with
you.
Okay.
Yes.
And you're probably not going to like my answer because I am going to mention habitat again. But it is, a logical conclusion that many people who spend time outdoors, who spend time hunting both of these species, have recognized is that, wow, those turkey populations have just exploded. And ruffed grouse populations, especially in the southwest corner of the state, have really diminished. And that was really the hotbed for turkey reintroductions at the time, too. So I think, first of all, it's a very logical thing to think to make as a pattern. What I would say, though, is that if you look at that woods that you've been hunting for the last 10, 20, 30 years, has there been any active management, harvest, timber stand improvement, things like that? So there was a researcher out of UW Richland Center at the time who put radio telemetry equipment on hen, on female ruffed grouse, and was kind of following them with their students. And if we look at some of the research by Dr. Walter, he was finding that it's a number of factors, but we've had a maturation of the forest. So we're not harvesting timber as much. Ruffed grouse need young forests, but they also need a diversity of age classes, not just young forests. So you can maintain ruffed grouse populations in oak forests too, but they need a mixture of young, or a mosaic, if you would, on the landscape of young, medium-aged, and old growth or older-aged timber resources. And with fragmentation and the loss of connectivity between habitats, if you think about, how woodlands have been fragmented in the Southwest or bought up, 40 acres at a time, that's created a lot of fragmentation as well, which can cause issues with predation as those grouse are moving across that landscape. So I would just say it's a combination of factors. Addressing specifically about turkey interactions, I do not disagree. I would not doubt that a turkey that is feeding and comes across a rough grouse nest, that they wouldn't disturb that nest or eat those eggs, or even very young poults that they could potentially catch, that they would harm them. They would eat them. But turkeys are an opportunistic forager. So it's whatever they're kind of coming across as they're moving through the woodlands and so on. I think they perhaps do depredate an occasional nest, but again, we haven't really documented that, or necessarily looking at that predation.
Another factor I'll mention, especially in like the lower two-thirds of the state, is that we have an overabundance of deer in many parts of that part of the state. And as deer get into forests, they will overeat that understory. And so as that understory density goes away, there's no cover for the ruffed grouse. But wild turkeys love that open understory because they get to see the predators from a long distance away. So it is, again, just to get back to what Jamie's saying, it is habitat related for sure.
Ken, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. David Drake and Jamie Nack are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. And then we'll be turning our attention to concrete and carbon dioxide and some new research on cement and concrete. But for the next half hour, it's wildlife with our guests. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. We'll take a quick look at the news and then we'll be back. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, back with David Drake, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Knack, UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Talking the world of wildlife and lots of callers online, so I think we can go right back to the phones. Perry in Oconto has been waiting a bit, so let's go there. Perry, hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, Larry, I just had a comment on the solar farms. And one of the things that I saw that was a 100,000 megawatt farm, solar farm, reduces CO2 emissions by 120 megatons of CO2 per year. And while I was on hold, I heard about the honeybees. And the honeybees, they can be pollinating native flowers in those solar farms. So I think it's a win-win, and we keep things like Line 5 out of Wisconsin.
All right. Perry, thanks very much for calling. That's another person heard from on the whole solar
another
business.
Another perspective, yes. I think you said 100,000 megawatts. I think you might have meant 1,000 megawatts.
Yeah.
Possibly. But yeah, there's a trade-off, obviously, with anything that's renewable energy versus traditional fossil fuels. There's always a trade-off in terms of impacts to the natural resource base.
Thank you for that comment. Mark in Wisconsin Dells, will go to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. I thought you might want to know or be interested in knowing when white-tailed bucks rub their velvet. Based on a published report in the Southeast Association and 500 deer involved, an average white-tailed buck rubs its velvet the first time when it's about 424 days old.
It's born. The younger it is when it rubs its velvet. After that, it is exactly 365 days till the next time it rubs its velvet, year after year after year.
That's interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. So it's really...
Mark, thanks for that information. That's pretty cool. I like that.
And I think he's referring to the Southeast Deer Research study.
Yeah,
absolutely. Mark, thank you very much for calling. You know, before we go too much further, we may have set up some misinterpretation about the wolf hunt.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit during the break, and I think the caller's question was, he was asking for an update on the wolf hunt or the wolf season. Yeah. And David was just sharing that you can find out about wolf management by going to the Department of Natural Resources website and looking at that. Not to confuse folks with the idea that there's an upcoming season that's going to happen. Yeah,
there is not. That's right.
Wolves, the gray wolves in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes area have been protected species, and they remain on the federally protected list since February of 2022. So nothing has changed there. They are a protected species in Wisconsin. And I know there's been talk of a couple of bills that they've been part of, in attempts to get them delisted and returning management back to the state. But I'm not up to speed on any current.
No, there's not. Yeah, we did not mean to infer that there's an upcoming season for sure. But yeah, just anything wolf related, if you have a question, go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and type in their search engine wolf, and they will be up to date with the most current information.
And again, you can join us. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. If you've got an experience to share or a question, I hope you'll join in. Brett in Abbotsford has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Brett.
Hi, good afternoon. Enjoying the show.
Thank you.
Trout traveling across the state and listening to the callers. I'm from Illinois. I hunt and fish quite a bit in Wisconsin, love everything about the state. But I have such a hard time getting a turkey tag, especially for the northern zones. I'm constantly being put into the last week of the year. This year I was unable to obtain a tag. And with all the turkeys that I see, with the numbers exploding, why does Wisconsin have this system where we have to declare a zone in a week? Why don't we just open it up like deer hunting, where it's a season and you get a tag and you fill the tag?
Yeah, so, good reasons for it.
Yeah, good question, Brett. The reason that we have zones and then a week-long period is to divide out the effort, the number of hunters out on the landscape at any given time. If we had an open, let's say you had your permit was good for 6 weeks and everybody else's was good for 6 weeks, then those first couple of weeks you're going to see a lot of intense pressure on both public and probably competition for access to private land as well. So it's really to distribute that effort over time and kind of give everybody an equal chance to harvest a bird. The way the turkey permits, and I'm most familiar with resident licensing and permitting, is that you put in, so we have both a fall and a spring harvest period for turkeys. The majority of people are hunting turkeys in the spring, and that's for a bearded bird, whether that's a tom or a hen with a beard, the bird has to have a beard on it. And the way you basically put in for your preference, I think that goes in by December 10th. You put in your preference for zone, preference for time period, and you get a couple of different choices. And then you'll eventually hear what you've been awarded in terms of permits. And so those go through, I guess it would be a lottery process, although landowners are given preferences within that. Allocating of harvest tags. And then after those have been divvied out, then I believe it's in March sometime, Larry, you probably know, I believe it's in March when the over-the-counter tags become available. So any leftover tags become available by zone and by time period, and you can purchase them online. In your case, you could do that online. So, and then they show the current availability online in real time as well.
And I'm not sure if there's preference to Wisconsin hunters over hunters from other states.
Yeah, and I don't have that answer either, but I'm sure we could find that answer, or we could reach out to the upland game bird biologist and ask a little bit more about how that's working. So I think it's worth a phone call just to understand the process from
maybe
your end.
Maybe we can bring that up at least next time you're on.
Yeah.
As an incidental note as we talk about it. I think the thing from the hunter's perspective, when you're out there hunting, the fact that it's not like the opening day of the deer season. I mean, the hunting is spread out, and so for the person who's actually doing the hunting, the quality of the experience is much better.
The other thing is, if we're putting all those, you know, we're wearing camouflage to hunt turkeys, and we're calling turkeys to us.
With turkey decoys.
Yes. So there's a safety aspect, too, by being able to kind of monitor how many people are out at the same time.
Yeah. A listener emailed to ask if red and gray foxes interbreed and produce offspring.
Huh. Good question. They probably could interbreed if they wanted to. The issue is that red foxes are more of an open land creature, so they are out in like farmland and grassland pasture type stuff, as well as into urban areas. Gray foxes are also in urban areas, but gray foxes are more of a forest associated species. And so they might run into each other on the edge of the forested areas. But most of the time that they're using two different types of habitats, and so they probably don't interact all that often, but they most likely could interbreed because they're both canid species in the dog family.
Another thing I wanted to bring up had to do with the chimney swift and the chimney swift count. We were talking last week on the show about some counts that are going on in citizen participation events, and but we didn't get to a couple of things, and one was Chimney Swifts.
Yeah.
David, you want to talk about
that? Yeah, I'll start, and Jamie, if you want to weigh in as well. Sure. Chimney Swifts are super cool little birds. They're insectivorous migratory birds, so they're starting to migrate out of our state now, and probably they're starting to move south out of the northern part of their state last month. Really cool birds. They're described as cigars with wings. So their body, the actual body looks like a cigar. And then they've got these kind of relatively longish tapered wings that allows them to be very maneuverable. A lot of times you hear them chattering before you see them. And you look up high in the sky and you'll see these little cigars with wings flying around. And those are the chimney swifts. And they're called chimney swifts partly because they're swift flying birds. But they are also... in more recent time, probably since the Industrial Revolution, have been associated with chimneys, especially industrial chimneys, but also brick chimneys and other chimneys on houses. Prior to their use of chimneys, they would use old-growth trees, cavities in old-growth trees, trees that have been topped, caves, things like that. But they've really associated with chimneys quite a bit. So you see them in urban areas and suburban areas. However, their population has been declining, and so there's some estimate that about 50% of the population has declined in the last 50 years or so, primarily because of the loss of industrial-sized chimneys as we're tearing down industries or putting scrubbers on those industrial chimneys to try to improve the air quality of the emission coming out of the chimney. People are also, for suburban residential chimneys, they're putting caps on their chimneys, primarily to keep raccoons and flying squirrels and things like that are also cavity nesters out of their chimney. And so the result is that chimney swifts are starting to lose some of their roosting and nesting habitat, and that's having an impact on their overall population. So they are migrating right now. They migrate. They're in the eastern half of the United States during the breeding season. They live in the winter in kind of the northwestern quadrant of South America. So they'll migrate across Gulf of Mexico, along the Texas Gulf Coast occasionally, things like that. And right now they're coming through the southern part of the state of Wisconsin. And so the Wisconsin Chimney Swift Working Group is starting a Chimney Swift Watch. So what they're asking people to do on at least a night, if you are familiar with chimney swifts in your area, to go out and try to find the roosts where chimney swifts are going into these chimneys, and go stage yourself in an area where you can see chimney swifts entering that roost about 30 minutes before the sundown, and count chimney swifts until 10 minutes after you've seen the last chimney swift enter that roost. Once you've done that, if you would go to eBird, if you're familiar with that, you can go onto eBird, and they want you to log the estimated number of chimney swifts you've counted. So you can count individuals, but if you get into a large flock of chimney swifts, start counting fives and tens, and don't worry about counting individual birds. So log the number of chimney swifts that you see, the date, and the location. And if you want to be a rock star, they would like you to also to note what type of chimney it is, whether it be industrial, residential, or other type, and then also the condition of the chimney, whether it's in good shape, bad shape, things of that nature. And then tag it with hashtag Wisconsin Swift, I think is what the Wisconsin Chimney Swift.
I can't remember
exactly what the hashtag is. And then if you don't want it to go through eBird, they've got a mailing address as well, so that you can mail that that account in. And then as an aside, if you are also seeing common nighthawks, they would like you to record those in addition to counting the chimney swifts. But if you go to the Wisconsin Chimney Swift Working Group, they've got some information on that. Again, if you're in the northern part of the state, it's probably too late for you to count the chimney swifts. They probably have already started migrating south. If you're in the southern part of the state of Wisconsin, you can count chimney swifts most likely through the rest of this month.
Yeah. And as long as we're on sightings, I know the game bird surveys are done for the year, but the deer surveys go on for another month, don't they,
Another
Jamie?
Month. So Operation Deer Watch. And again, this is done through the Department of Natural Resources. It's an opportunity for citizen science to enter their observations. It's done in the months of August and September, so you've got a whole month to go yet. This is one of those great opportunities to involve your children or grandchildren, especially as it involves downloading an app, which isn't that complicated. But if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, just type in Operation Deer Watch. There's an it'll get you to the page, and it's very easy, couple of steps to download the app. The app is called Survey 123, and it walks you right through how to do it. Once you have that on your phone, you go ahead and open up that app, and you can record your sightings, your observations. And so this is done during daylight hours, so the times when you are not using your headlights on your car, so dawn to dusk. You want to make sure that you're not on the app or on your phone while you're driving, but you're essentially driving around and looking for deer and then entering the location. If you're doing it on your phone, your phone's GPS will grab that location for you, so it makes entering very easy. And then you're essentially recording any deer that you see. If you do see a buck, that's fine. If you see a lone doe, that's fine. If you see a doe with two fawns or a doe with three fawns, those are the types of observations. You're recording the location, what you're seeing, and entering that. What they don't want you to report or to record is trail camera photos, because when a trail camera takes a picture, there could be another fawn outside of the range of the picture. It could bias those results. So they don't accept trail camera photos. And then also, if you're looking around your home and you're always seeing a doe with two fawns and you know it's the same one, you report it once. You don't report it every single day. And then essentially the state will look at that data, and they're trying to develop the fawn to doe ratio. And that ratio gives us an indication or a trend or an index of what the spring reproduction looked like, in this case for white-tailed deer. And that information will actually go into population models then to look at whether the population is increasing, decreasing, or remaining stable for that given county. So it helps to determine an index of recruitment for this spring.
I want to go back to chimney swifts for a minute, because the hashtag is hashtag SwiftWI.
Yeah, I just found that as well, so thanks for mentioning that.
Okay. Bobby emailed to ask if a single line of electric fence could keep deer out of their yard, and if so, how high should it be?
Well, the short answer is that it might work, but only for a very short period of time. Eventually, the deer are going to find their way either under it, over it, possibly through it. And if you're using a single wire instead of the tape, you probably want to flag that wire in some way every 10 or 15 or 20 feet, just so the deer know that the wire is there, because otherwise, as they're running, they may not see it, and they may just run right through it. In terms of height, you want it probably to be about 2 to 3 feet off the ground or above the ground, so it hits them between their knee and their chest, something in that manner. If you want to also increase your effectiveness of that fence for as long as it might be effective, you could make what's called a peanut butter fence. So you would take a strip of aluminum foil, for example, put some peanut butter on one end of that aluminum foil. Double the foil over itself so that it's touching the fence. The deer will be attracted to the peanut butter. When they go to lick the peanut butter, then they get a shock from the fence. Then it reinforces the fact that the fence is there. The other thing I'll mention, you said about around your yard, if you're in a residential community, just make sure, for one thing, it's legal according to municipal ordinance for you to do this. But number two, if you've got kids running around, pet dogs and other things like that, you just may want to be a little bit careful, because that could be a bit of a hazard for people who may not be aware of the fences there.
I was thinking about my days as a youth on the farm and
touching
taking
the fence.
A blade of grass.
Yeah,
blade of, I usually used a weed.
Yeah.
It was a little bit longer.
Yeah.
until you got the shot.
Yep.
John has a question about bats and the recovery, and how's the bat recovery going? Jamie, do you want to chime in on that?
I'm happy to share some really good news. I think on this program, David and I probably promoted the Great Wisconsin Bat Count, and the way we count bats, and that's both with biologists or with citizen science, as we've been talking about throughout the show, is that for bats, similar to the chimney swifts, we are looking for summer roosts, and we're doing a count in June, and we're he's taking an evening at dusk and counting the bats that are emerging for a specific couple of days, and then repeating that survey in July when the young pups of the year are now able to fly. So you count pre-volency before they're able to fly, and then post or at volency. And so the data was just coming back or reported with the 2025 results. And the Great Wisconsin Bat Count observed nearly 25,000 bats as they emerged from their daytime roosts. And that was up from 22,600 that were counted in July of last year. And so the biologists are certainly appreciative of all of that efforts by citizen scientists. But they said that both big and little brown bats have increased, have 3 years in a row now increased in numbers, and that is giving them and us hope for their recovery of bats, especially the hibernating bats in Wisconsin. And we're really talking about what the impacts had been of white nose syndrome. So we're seeing some increasing trends.
DNR is paying people for their red and white pine cones. And the agency wants pine cones, red ones, and they have to be in good shape, too.
Yeah.
But what's...
Yeah, was it $125 a bushel for, I think, the red, and $70 a bushel or $100 a bushel for the whites, or vice versa?
Half and half. The reds are smaller.
Smaller, take longer to collect, to fill a bushel.
So that's $125 for those?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then $70 for white pine.
Yeah, so that's, they're trying to increase the amount of seed for their state nurseries. Mm-hmm. So go do this, but make sure that if you're doing it on public land that you are permitted and allowed to do that. If you're on private land, make sure you've got permission of the landowner if it's not your own land. And if you want to go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website, they've got some really good information about how to do this, the specifics of what they're looking for. One of the things they mentioned is they list a number of state nurseries, and they ask you to contact the nursery ahead of time just to make sure they're still accepting the seed and things like that. But yeah, that'd be a kind of a fun fall activity, especially out on a nice day with your family. And go do good.
Help with the forest reforestation.
Yes, for sure.
And make some money in the process.
Yeah.
Well, why not? I think I've covered almost everything that I needed to recover that wasn't brought up by emailers or phone callers. The last thing I wanted to mention was that for hunting, the hunting season now, we've got over 6 million acres of public land, and folks who are interested and don't have their own land, the DNR has a public access land tool online.
Yes, there's a number of different resources for finding public land. One is called F-Flight, and that's for finding game bird hunting locations, so whether that's rough grouse and looking at timber harvest, the properties that are stocked with ringneck pheasants are listed in that as well. I'm trying to think what other, and then as you said, the I'm trying to think of
public lands,
the public access. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you both very much. We'll see you in a couple of months, and we'll do it again.
Sounds great. Thank you, Larry.
All right. Jamie Knack and David Drake, our guests, UW Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor is David, and Jamie Knack, UW Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both affiliated with the Division of Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Coming up next, we'll talk about how concrete can be made without contributing as much to the problem of global warming. That next, I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. We're turning our attention to cement and concrete. Concrete is everywhere, pretty much. It's the most widely used building material in the world, and The making of it creates greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming, but concrete can be manufactured to produce less carbon dioxide, and that kind is becoming more common. And we're going to talk about concrete and cement today with Kevin McDonald. Kevin is an associate professor in the UW Stout College of Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, and Management, and is director of the Bachelor of Science Construction Management Program. And they're doing some pretty cool things at Stout with this. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. Have you ever noticed how much concrete surrounds you? You know that the manufacturing of concrete creates a lot of greenhouse gas emissions? Give a call. Number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. And Kevin McLeod, thank you for joining us today.
Terrifically. Thank you so much. And it's Kevin McDonald.
Kevin McDonald. I'm sorry. Did I give you
the... No problem.
Oh, all right. Well, it's great to have you with us, Kevin. Before we get started and talking about the project that you've got going at Stout, I wanted to spend a minute or two talking about the relationship between cement and concrete, because I think there's sometimes confusion about the two. Can you talk about the relationship between cement and concrete?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and I agree. There's often quite a bit of confusion. The best way to say it is that cement is to concrete as flour is to cake. Cement is the glue that reacts with water to hold the constituent materials together. And so if you have about 4,000 pounds of concrete, you may have 15% of that weight would be cement, the remainder of it being rocks and sand and water. So concrete and cement are not the same thing. Cement is the glue that holds the concrete together.
And I there have been a time or two when somebody has said cement when they meant concrete, and they're quickly disabused of that by callers. How is cement made itself?
So Portland cement, which is the most common type of cement that we manufacture, as we've been doing it for about 150 or so years now, it's made by taking limestone, a source of calcium carbonate, and clay, which is a source of aluminates, and then some little bit of some silica and some iron, and we burn that in a kiln, in a kiln at thousands of degrees. And the first step is that calcium carbonate, limestone, becomes calcium oxides, lime, and carbon dioxide gas. And then in order to get the ingredients heated up, we have to burn fuels to do that. And so after that material has partially melted, it undergoes a series of chemical reactions, a big long tube, hundreds of feet long, that is rotating all of the time. Out the ash or the burned material that comes out of the bottom is called clinker. If we grind that and we add it with a couple of things to that, we get a powder that will set underwater by hydraulic action. And so that's the main manufacturer for cement. We'll add in Wisconsin, we're adding about 10 or so percent of limestone. And we have to add a little bit of gypsum, of calcium sulfate as well, to slow down one of the chemical reactions. But for a ton of the clinker, the material that's coming out of the kiln, we generate about a ton of carbon dioxide. So it's very carbon intensive.
And when you put it on a worldwide scale, it's amounts to a fair amount of the total carbon dioxide emissions, if I'm not mistaken.
You're exactly correct. More than cars and more than airplanes. And having worked in concrete for more than 40 years now, as engineers, we have to take some responsibility of can we meet the societal needs that we have? And concrete is ubiquitous. We make the thousands of pounds of it per person on Earth per year. Can we do so without and minimize or reduce or eliminate, if we can, our impact on the environment. And that's what I've been working on, both in industry and in academia for more than 40 years.
And there's been some progress on this. And there's, I guess, something called low carbon concrete. And how is that made that might be different from the normal, quote-unquote, process,
yeah.
Kevin?
So one of the things that we use, and it's an odd word, a pozzolan. A pozzolan is a material that will react with the cement to get us additional strength. And that's how the Romans made concrete. They didn't have cement. They had to burn limestone to get lime. But we can replace that clinker with other waste products, products from burning of coal, products from the manufacture of steel. And that's where I had been working, the St. Croix Crossing between Minnesota and Wisconsin, and many bridges in the Twin Cities. I've designed designed the concretes for that have 70 to 90% of the clinker replaced. And that reduces significantly the amount of emissions. And so we've been able to do some of those things, and that reduces the emissions that are associated with the concrete materials.
So when you're done, do you have, I'm thinking about the difference in the concrete. Is it, how different is it? It sounds like it's quite a bit different from the traditional then.
Yeah, so pozzolan-containing concrete has many of the same minerals. The CSH, or calcium silicate hydrate, is the glue that holds everything together. When you use fly ash, when you use slag, you get some different minerals, but you also get a lot of the same CSH. And so that under the microscope, the material is similar in appearance. And in many cases, it's similar in chemistry. There are other options that we have been looking at, and in particular, what probably caused you and I to meet is the work we've been doing, putting in sidewalks here on the UW Stout campus that don't have any clinker in them at all, and that are designed to be made with 100%, the binder is 100% waste product, and you can use recycled concrete, old concrete, because it's a chemical reaction. You can't remelt it like a wax and use it over again. And so you can use it to make more concrete. And so there are lots of different ways of getting the binder together that are much cleaner, much lower in emissions. Of course, nothing is free, but and it doesn't. It's surprisingly good to extract materials from seawater, and we think here in Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Dakotas, we don't have a lot of seawater, but anywhere producing oil, there's a brine sitting on the top of the oil in the deposit, and so we can get some of the minerals that we need to make concrete out of a surprising number of places.
That's pretty cool, Kevin. How did this project become a teaching opportunity?
Well, like anything else, we're educating people to be lifelong learners here at UW Stout, and our polytechnic approach is to do hands-on learning, and so we've always we always make concrete and have in our classes for some time. And I had started to make some concretes that were made in alternate uses with sometimes activated slag, sometimes geopolymers. And it's a different mechanism. And unlike the pozzolan material, we get different minerals that we're growing. And so we have some renovations going on campus. We're reconstructing one of the buildings. And as a consequence, we had to move a bus stop. And so we've been working on these alternate concretes and suggested that we could have the students make concrete and construct with that a sidewalk that they would use, but also would give them some hands-on training. And so some of these materials, other people have used them before, but they're always making in small laboratory quantities. And in order for this material to be able to help us with our issues with respect to global warming, we need to be able to construct with it. And so we had a donation of some raw materials from Semstone Products Company. My connection there is I used to be their chief engineer, and we made, instead of making small quantities of concrete in the laboratory, we made truckload quantities for a sidewalk.
Very, very cool. We're talking today with Kevin McDonald, associate professor in the UW's Stout College of Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, and Management, and director of this Bachelor of Science Construction Management program. As I'm talking with him, I think, man, I would love to have a class from this guy. He knows what he's talking about, and I like the way that we're applying it to help students learn more. Questions about cement or concrete, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk with our guest, Kevin McDonald from UW Stout, about some research that he's done relating to low-carbon concrete and a really cool project that's going on at UW Stout to actually put into place and get student involvement in the development of a little research project that's probably going to be ongoing for quite a while. To use this low-carbon concentrator concrete. Again, questions for him, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. What was this mixture like to work with, Kevin?
Yeah, that was the critical thing, is that if it couldn't be placed properly, so we brought it in at about, it was not quite flowing concrete, but it was very liquid. We were able to, we had about 70 minutes from the time of discharge to where we couldn't work it anymore, and that's a little shorter than conventional concrete. There's things we can do to adjust it. I mean, there's always it's a chemical reaction, and so we can add chemicals to change how the reaction is going. But the important thing that we wanted to find out is that if we used, you know, we have a student construction association. They do great work, but they're students, and they're very good at carpentry. To see whether we could get something to work out and what the implications would be. So it was easy to work with. It laid down. We had a dry day, and dry days are difficult because the concrete starts to crust over. So it isn't the greatest looking finish in the world, but that wasn't part of the goal was to see, can we get it to last long enough to put it down? And of course, the big environmental impact that we have here in Wisconsin is freezing and thawing in the presence of de-icing salts. So we have a number of instruments inside the slab that will help us to monitor that.
That is.
We also track.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, my fault. I gave you too long of a pause. We track the temperature, and even in May in the sun, it was as high as 140 degrees Fahrenheit and as low as 60 degrees overnight. So it's undergone a lot of thermal stresses. But so far, we have no uncontrolled cracking.
Very, very cool. A number of callers with questions. Dave in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, could we kill two birds with one stone and possibly reuse ground up plastic and concrete together for building materials?
Yeah, I've been involved in a couple of projects where we take recycled turbine fans, you know, from wind turbines, then they eventually come to the end of their useful life, and use those as both aggregate and as reinforcement. There has been some work done in just using plastics. The better place to put plastic is in asphalt. Black roads that you see, and because then you get a modification of some of the asphalt properties. Concrete and concrete materials or ceramics, polymers like plastics, they don't bond quite as well as other recycled concrete would be. But there is a colossal amount of effort going into trying to find places where we make waste. Can we put that waste somewhere else where it becomes useful and not landfill?
Yeah. Dave, thank you for calling. Barbara in Montello, we'll go to you. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I was wondering if you've done anything with hempcrete, where they use lime with the hemp and they can build houses and things like that, that they would do with concrete as well. And it captures carbon as well.
Yes, it does. And so you get the hemp fibers that capture carbon. Most concretes will also react and pull carbon dioxide out of the air. The one we have at UW Stout does it particularly well. But I'm familiar with hempcrete, and in terms of a sort of user-friendly type material, it's very easy to use. I was just talking to my students this morning. Some of the oldest concrete is made with lime as the binder. Lime has to carbonate in order to become non-soluble in water. But hempcrete is particularly a democratic building material, fairly easy to work with, and it doesn't require special skills. This is an excellent use of material.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you for calling. And let's go to Mark in Sussex. Mark, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the show. I was wondering about the sand usage in concrete. I was reading something, I think it was in India, where there's a severe shortage of sand, and it's really expensive. Is there a difference in the sand that they get than the sand from, like, Saudi Arabia, where they seem to have quite a bit?
An excellent question. I've been doing some work in UAE, where they use a lot of dune sand, which the difficulty with sand of that type is it's blown around, so that it's very rounded in its single-size particles. But you are right, and it sounds silly, but we're running out of sand throughout the world, and it doesn't seem reasonable. But what I mean is of good quality sand that's usable in concrete and that is readily accessible. And part of that is because when we first started building, the best sites to build on are those that drain well, and the ones that drain well have sand underneath them. And so in many places, we have housing sitting on top of all the sand that we might need. So there are some ways of getting around that problem, but generally you want sand that is slightly rounded, but that has many different particle sizes so that it packs well together. If a single size sand, which is often what we end up with, gives us problems, and manufactured sand or sand made by crushing also gives us problems. So although it sounds hard to imagine, we are running out of quality sand.
It's very interesting. Mark, thank you very much for calling. There's several emails. Ted emailed to ask about the use of graphene to strengthen concrete. Is it effective?
Yes, it is. You can use graphene and in the fiber sizes that give you very good reinforcement. One of the interesting things, Larry, you can do with graphene is you can make concrete that it will better conduct electricity. It's like the topic of my boring PhD 30 years ago. But one of the cool uses for it is if we had a system where you could charge an electric vehicle while it drove down the highway. So you have solar panels collect electricity, and then the road itself acts as a charger of the type you may have. You put your phone down and you get an induction charging. Yeah. There's a lot of technology that is being developed that, you know, that we don't have to do things the way we've always done them. We can think about how to integrate our environmental problems into our societal solutions a little bit better.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. And Dwayne in Stevens Point has a comment for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dwayne.
Hi. I'm enjoying your show immensely. I wanted to ask a question regarding the mortar or concrete that is holding my silo together. It was built around 1900. And recently I wanted to enlarge a hole in the side of the silo. And I had a heck of a time just chipping away with a chisel and a hammer. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like 125 years old. You know, what were they using back then?
Interesting. So
at that time, it's probably a lime mortar. So it's made with hydraulic lime. And those materials can get very, very strong. We wouldn't use some Portland cement in mortars today, but there still is some lime in mortars. The difficult part is that you want the mortar to be strong enough that you don't have structural problems, but not as strong as the staves that are in that concrete silo, so that when you have a crack or if you have a stress that's going to cause a crack, the crack occurs in the mortar. Because then you can rake the mortar out and repair it as opposed to the damaging the staves. But it's probably, if it's very, very hard, is it very light in color?
Yes, it was. It is. The walls are about 18 inches thick, and the mortar or concrete is binding granite, broken granite rocks.
Yeah, so it's probably a hydraulic lime. They can get very strong. They continue to gain strength with time.
Yeah, very interesting. Duane, thank you very much for calling. Mark emailed to say they're replacing a sidewalk, but want to reduce the amount of impervious surface. Is there any concrete product that accomplished this and still stand up to our freeze-thaw issues?
In fact, there is a colleague of mine, Mary Vancura, did a PhD in this very topic. We call it pervious concrete, and if you place it properly, it is open graded. So there's gravel and there's binder, but there's no sand. And so if you pour water onto the surface, it runs through the sidewalk and not across the sidewalk, and as a result. We did some work in a couple of cities in the Twin Cities, a couple of outlying cities, where they were right on lakes. And so rather than have the water run across the surfaces of the pavement and be collected in drains, it just drains right into the aquifer and into the lake. So it's pervious concrete. You can make it freeze-thaw durable. It's more difficult, more of a challenge to do so than for conventional concrete. But if you go to a search engine and look at pervious concrete, there's a lot of information.
And thanks very much for that question. How widely is low-carbon concrete used in construction?
Not as much as it should be. And one of the reasons is that, you know, we have building codes. And the building codes are changing, and it's probably a good thing not to change them too quickly, but they do also act as a conservative approach. The second is we learned a lot about Portland cement by using it. And all of these alternate materials, we are going to, in the same way, learn a lot about using it. So we want to go sufficiently quickly, but not so fast that if we have a concrete that has a very low emissions, but it doesn't last very long, then in the long run, those are high emission materials. And so we need to continue to develop it, and that's part of what we're doing at UW South, not just researching can we make this material with these alkali activations, but can we put it down in a real project using real labor, and how does it perform? And so that's the polytechnic difference, right, is a hands-on learning so that we see how these things operate.
Well, Kevin, I tell you what, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I want to get you back. It'd be fun to get an update as the research goes along to see how that's working. Thank you so much for being with us today. Kevin McDonald, Associate Professor at UW Stout in the College of Science, Technology, Engineering, Mathematics, and Management, and Director of that Construction Management Program. That we were talking about. They're doing some great work there, and we'll get him back and we'll do it again. Thank you so much for being with us today. Big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.